You're listening to Within Our Reach, a podcast by Reachability Association that focuses on accessibility, inclusion, and leveling the playing field at work and in your community. This week, we're discussing fitness and disability with fitness instructor Terry Roberts. Enjoy the episode.
I'm Shelley. I'm one of the co-hosts, and I'm here with...
I'm Blake. It's nice to be here again. Hello.
Hello. So we're here, and today we have a very interesting topic, and I'm going to let Terry introduce herself, but we have... We're going to be talking today about our journey of fitness as it relates to perhaps disability, right? And your wellness journey. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited about that. Perhaps it'll allow me to jog out of here.
I'm not going to lie. I was thinking here. I was like, good, this may motivate me to get back on my own fitness journey today.
Well, at least we're on the same page.
Yep, like, right? We're trying. Okay. We're trying to get
Let's
there.
Let's follow up on Monday and see what we did on the weekend.
But we have someone who is constantly getting there and helping others get there today. So Terry Roberts, thank you for joining us. And why don't you tell the listeners who you are.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you both. And I love coming into Reachability and talking about fitness. I'm here about once a month now to do this. Mm-hmm. So my name is Terry Roberts. I wear many hats, many hats.
You fit in well around here.
But the thing that I'm best known for, the thing I identify with most is being a fitness instructor. And I've been a fitness instructor for getting close to 20 years now. And prior to that, I trained in dance and then in education, and then fitness kind of evolved out of that. And it became my accidental career. It was going to be my side gig. And then for quite a few years, it became my full-time career. I ended up teaching the courses to become a fitness instructor, running the Provincial Fitness Instructors Association for 10 years, doing my academic research in fitness as well. So I've kind of had many, many different areas of the fitness industry blend into my day-to-day work.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Mm-hmm. So you let's start with what you're doing at Reachability. I think you're in doing some fitness. So let's tell our listeners about that.
What I do here is, this started actually several years ago. I got a call from Amanda here at Reachability. I was the ED for the Nova Scotia Fitness Association at the time. And she asked if there was somebody in this area of the city who could come in and do a talk with the folks who attend courses here. And I said, well, I actually happen to be literally the closest person to you, so I'll come over.
I think you're basically our neighbor.
Like a stone's throw from the office here, literally a stone's throw. You can pitch a rock into my driveway from here. And I said, yeah, I'll pop over. And so I did a couple of workshops with her sitting in to kind of get a feel of like what people needed, what was the right level of instruction, what was too much information or not enough, what the questions were going to be like, that kind of thing. So that, then from there, I sort of crafted two workshops that I do frequently here. I was doing them every 2 weeks. I was doing one and then the other, but now I've kind of combined them and I'm here once a month. And so I do a session on safe stretching and what stretching is. Mm-hmm. And then I do a similar session on strength training. So I do a strength week and a stretch week.
Okay.
And now I'm kind of blending the two together.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right.
So how did you, and I know you talk about this a lot, because then we're going to plug everything you're doing thoroughly at the end of the episode. So stay tuned. Terry is a very busy person with lots to talk about here. But you do public speaking. You talk about your journey of how you got into this sort of sector of fitness and wellness, and it started from what little I've read about you with a traumatic accident. So if you're comfortable telling us this, which I know you are because you talk about this professionally, I think it's going to be a very interesting journey to hear about. So how did this really start?
So coming up pretty soon, it will be the 34th anniversary of the car crash that I was injured in.
Okay.
And I had some experience with disability before that. I was born with some vision impairment. So I've already been through the medicalization of all of that and the system of all of that and the being a pediatric patient and all of that. So in 1990, I was on my way out to have coffee with a couple of friends and was struck by an impaired driver.
Okay.
So we don't actually refer to it as a car accident. We refer to it as a car crash in impaired driving parlance, because
there's no accidental.
There's no accident. Right. It could have been prevented.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. I agree.
And at the time, organizations that help victims of impaired driving didn't exist in Canada yet.
Okay.
So I was injured before Mad Canada. came to be.
Right.
The first Mad Canada chapter opened, I think it was the following year, and in Toronto. And then it was another 3 years, I believe, after that, that we finally got a chapter in Nova Scotia. So I and my family, we navigated this with no help. So I got to, you know, and I was a teenager, so I got to understand from a young age, not just the medicalization of accidents and injuries and disabilities, but also the legal system around it in certain cases.
Can you describe what you mean by medicalization, just for people listening to?
Sure. So there is a whole system behind medical treatment. You don't just walk into a doctor, get treated, and walk out. There are biases in medical care about who's. It's less so now. It's been handled better in training for medical staff now, but back then, you know, biases about the patient, biases about the circumstance in which you were injured, which happened in my case, things like that. So it's this whole other industry that you have to navigate. Same thing with the legal system. It's a whole other industry you have to navigate that you've just had thrust upon you because of random life circumstances, whether that be a disability or a disease you are born with or you acquire later in life, or an injury in life like I acquired. So there's a lot of stuff around there that just does not make any of this straightforward.
And with no advocacy back then, advocacy. Even more tough.
And full disclosure, I do volunteer with Mad Canada, with the local chapter here in Halifax, because, and people ask me all the time, oh, do you volunteer with Mad because they helped you after your injury? I'm like, no, they didn't exist yet.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
I help with Mad Canada so nobody has to go through this alone like I did.
Yeah. I think that would make you twice the passionate advocate than if you had to have that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because it is, you don't want to have to deal with all of that on your own. And there's an additional sort of stigma and layer, several layers of problematization when your disability or your injury comes from somebody's criminal activity.
Okay.
And that's one of the things Matt has done really well over the years, and has done, you know, supported a lot of research and stuff in that, because I had a number of injuries. Obviously, I was a pedestrian who survived a car crash. I mean, being struck by a vehicle. So I still have a permanent lump on my head. I have a rib that doesn't sit flat anymore because of the break there. It didn't heal properly. I have had a couple of injuries or a couple of surgeries to repair the injuries on my left elbow. And it makes clicky noises now. There's all kinds of things to go along with it. So partially because of my age at the time, I didn't get sufficient post-surgical medical treatment. Okay. I didn't get physiotherapy, things like that. The belief at the time was, well, kids bounce back. And
so you're just left to your own
healing
devices.
I just left to my own devices to heal on my own. And I asked, I mean, this was, again, it was the early 90s. It was early days. It was practically the Dark Ages. And
it wasn't the Oregon Trail, but we weren't that far. Yeah, I getcha.
Yeah. And I was shocked when I did join Mad Canada, which I just had my 15th anniversary of joining Mad. And I was shocked when I first sat down with our then regional director. She's now retired. And we were up here at the Starbucks here in Clayton Park. And I said, and you know what they said to me about not why they wouldn't give me medical treatment and physio? And she said, they told you kids bounce back, don't they? And I went, oh my God, you knew that? And she said, oh, you have no idea how many times we've heard that across the country. So it's not just a local phenomenon. It's not just Nova Scotia has a doctor shortage and we have for 50 years. This has been a nationally established thing at the time. And my jaw dropped because she was finishing my sentences in that meeting for the stuff that I was told. And I mean, at that point, it had been, you know, almost 20 years since I'd been injured.
Yeah.
And we were still hearing that stuff. And that was a lot of what really motivated me to volunteer. There was a lot of that. There was also, because the person who injured me was generally a good person. He wasn't a career criminal. He wasn't, you know, the local sociopath in my hometown.
Yeah.
He was not, you know, it was somebody who made very poor choices on one night of his life, and it impacted me. And he really, unlike some impaired driving offenders, he really did take it seriously.
Okay.
And he really, he's no longer around, but he, for the rest of his life, he was remorseful.
Okay.
And that's quite unusual, actually.
Yeah. Well, I think it's unusual to hear that acknowledged by the victim of the circumstance, too, to be honest. That's
Yeah.
That's quite big of
everybody. And so it was my story in that sense is quite different. But I was in a small town, everybody knows everybody kind of town. And there was reluctance among some of the medical professionals at the time to acknowledge that what he did was a crime.
Really?
Because they didn't want him to be punished for it. This was somebody they knew. This was their neighbor, their friend, their, you know.
But you're a kid.
But I was a kid.
Who's been mowed down by, okay.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let, I said at the start of this, I wasn't going to get on a soapbox, so I'm not going to get too impassioned.
And this is precisely it, is I was a teenager in junior high.
Yeah, okay.
And
so quite young.
I was in the eighth grade. So why was I being held responsible? I wasn't even old enough to drive yet. And why was I being held responsible? Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to me. Part of what put me on my eventual path towards academic research, and particularly feminist theory in my academic work, was there was also a gender element to how I was treated. Mm-hmm. Because what was a young girl her age doing in the evening where she could have been walking across the street at that time to be hit? Well, I'm sorry, but wrong place, wrong time is not an excuse.
Terry, I just said I didn't want to get impassionately angry, and here we go.
Sorry, like, go ahead, fire it off.
No.
You guys planned this beforehand. No.
There's no need to plan.
I tried to, like,
this is why we're friends, right?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
But this really fascinated me, because at the time, the public discourse around how women were treated in criminal cases as victims was still, I mean, the Anita Hill case was just breaking loose in the States. Mm-hmm. So things like sexual harassment, all of this stuff was going on. So there was news and public discourse around this. And then it was also playing out in a slightly different way in my own life. Mm-hmm. And I look at people and go, did you think because I was a teenage girl, I was under house arrest?
Yeah.
It was 6 o'clock in the evening when I was injured. It was not like I was out at 2 a.m. and drunk.
Yeah.
And even if I had been, I still didn't deserve to be hit by an impaired driver.
I was just going to say, exactly, because you were walking.
Because I was walking across the street.
Yeah. How dare you?
And people say, well, why did you walk? I'm like, he came around a curve. You can't see around a curve.
Yeah.
Sorry. I don't have x-ray vision.
Also, did we all forget the part where this grown adult driver was drunk behind the wheel? Maybe we should focus on that.
And to be fair, part of the problem was at the time, the laws around impaired driving aren't what they are now.
Correct.
Mm. And again,
which is why we needed MAD Canada.
This is why we needed MAD.
Because they have done a lot of good.
And MAD has done a lot of advocacy and changes around that. And we're still working on that at the national and provincial levels. And what he was actually charged with basically amounts to a driving ticket.
Oh my God.
It wasn't a crime against a person at the time.
Yeah, so there's absolutely no recognition of the utter damage that was done to you.
There was no
over
vehicular
the long term
manslaughter. There was no vehicular attempted manslaughter at the time.
No. So you really got just left fully out on every frontier from
absolutely.
The sounds of it. So, okay, so after all of this... Mm-hmm.
And then
how
I had medical
do you start
people.
To learn and advocate for yourself at such a young age? How did that start?
Well,
to happen?
It didn't start right away because I was refused. The surgeon who did the work on my broken elbow was fantastic. Everybody else, and he was new to the area. He wasn't a local, which I think is very telling. Mm-hmm. Everybody else who could have had some hand in my medical treatment basically covered their ears and went la la la. I can't hear you. I was fortunate that I had already been involved in dance and that I continued that involvement. It was a bit of a struggle after the immediate recovery phase from the crash, but it saved me in the long run because I was refused physiotherapy, which is mind-blowing today. But at the time, physiotherapy is not really a thing.
You're not the most vulnerable among us.
Yeah.
You're just made
you'll
of rubber,
back.
Apparently.
Yeah, you'll bounce back. And, of course, there's the idea, girls are just dramatic. Teenage girls are just dramatic, right? And I'm like, I have got several broken things. Mm-hmm. Are you serious?
I was hit by a car, in case we need to remind
In fact, it wasn't,
you.
To be technical, it wasn't even a car. It was a half-ton truck.
Oh, dear God.
It was a half-ton truck. And mostly I was just sort of, as they say, clipped by it. It was the corner of the headlight that
sounds like more than enough to me.
There was plenty to throw me in the air and me land on the pavement.
Let's just talk about, like, how much is that, like, 8,000 pounds or something.
Something like that,
You know, 100 pounds, right? There's going to be, like, just think about that for a second. Like, I've had to say that to people, right? Like, it doesn't matter what speed they're going, okay? There's not a contest.
No, clipped. Okay. Clipped sounds mild until you follow exactly. it up with buy a truck.
So you kept up with dance. So dance became your physiotherapy.
It basically did. Yeah, yeah. And I think if I hadn't already been trained in that, I after my arm re-knit and healed up, I continued on with music. I was learning a couple of different instruments at the time. And I think if I hadn't been doing both of those things, I would have gone downhill very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I say that because several years later, when I finished high school and I went off to university and I wasn't playing music and I wasn't doing dance, my condition deteriorated rapidly.
Okay. All right.
And so in early 1997, so 7 years or 6.5 years after I was injured, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia.
Okay.
And at the time, fibromyalgia was not a clear definition, and it wasn't the definition it currently has. If I were to be presenting in a doctor's office with those symptoms and things now, fibro wouldn't be the diagnosis.
Okay.
Because now fibromyalgia is considered an autoimmune disease. Yes. At the time, there was no real understanding of the cause, and it was just sort of what doctors call a wastebasket diagnosis.
Yes.
Right? They just chuck it in the basket.
Yeah, I don't know, so it's fibro.
Stick it in there. So it was that, although the doctors I had moved here to Halifax, so the doctors I had here were trying to figure it out, but really had nowhere to look and no guidance on these things at that time. So today I wouldn't call it fibromyalgia, but that's what we were using for the terminology at the time. And I was fortunate enough to get some pharmaceutical help to sort of break me out of the cycle of muscle pain and fatigue that I had. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate that a neighbor of mine had just trained in massage therapy, and she's she's now retired, unfortunately. I'm like, come out of retirement, please. But she was quite brilliant at figuring out where specific injuries happened that were never found and never diagnosed at the time of my recovery from the crash, because I was refused that help. Mm-hmm. So I was having like lots of headaches and jaw pain and things like this. And she's like, that's not your head and your jaw. That's your neck and your shoulder that were injured. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, it makes sense that I have that shoulder injury based on what I understand of physics in the human body. Mm-hmm. So it was a long time for me to get worse. And then it was a fairly long time for me to recover from all of that. Right. But again, by the late 90s, I finally had some help.
Mm-hmm. But still informal help. There's still no systemic help being
informal,
addressed here.
Yep. Okay. And then after I finished university in the early 2000s, I did a BA and a BED back to back. So I did a long stretch in university as an undergrad. Mm-hmm. I was there forever. We used to joke I was the Van Wilder of the Mount. I just never left. I got back into dance shortly after. A friend of mine was teaching dance classes at the rec center. I was finally available with time and I had, you know, a job. So I had some recreational money to spend. And I went into dance and I finally started feeling really good. And I could feel a difference in my brain because one of the things that wasn't diagnosed in 1990 was that I had a serious concussion, very serious concussion. And I was told I wasn't concussed because I didn't lose consciousness. And even in the early 90s, that was not the definition of a concussion.
Yeah.
So I can only chalk it up to, again, the age, the gender discrimination, sex discrimination, and local medical people's uncomfortableness around the fact that it was their friend that injured me.
Right.
And had I had some proper neurological care at the time, I think things would have gone very differently for me. But they refused to believe that I was actually concussed.
Okay. Right.
And I can clearly tell that now. And again, in that initial conversation with the director, local regional director for MAD, she said, oh, you were concussed. You are welcome to tell people you had a concussion. Because I'd say, well, I can't say I had a concussion because I wasn't diagnosed. She said, you can say it. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. I can say it. She's like, there's no doubt in my mind you were concussed. Your head hit the pavement. Of course you were concussed.
But yet again, it still blows my mind. Every bit of expert advice, help, anything that you've gotten here has been something you've sought out yourself, has been informal, has been a neighbor, there's no one who's professionally responsible in the system as it exists that took any form of responsibility here I can see so far. Okay. Yeah. All right. I'm keeping my impassioned nature down. Shelley, I see the look, but I just want to acknowledge the circumstances that got us here.
His, he's just reiterating his voice isn't rising. So no, this is no. a good thing.
I'm keeping my yes, outrage tamp down, but I want every listener to know it's there.
You want to scream into the void.
I would imagine it's shared with some of our listeners already. Oh, absolutely. Okay. This really explains to me why you've become who you are, though, where you're such an advocate and you're giving people all of this information. It makes complete sense to me because there, but for the grace of a lot of luck, go you, really.
Absolutely. But it was taking the dance classes that was the real aha moment for me, because I didn't realize until I got back into dance, having been out of it for six or so years at that point, that my brain felt like it was coming back online again.
Okay.
You know when you have an interruption to your internet connection and you get the swirly thing on the screen and it finally comes back online and you just go, oh, I felt like that was happening in my brain. And a few more years later, when I went back into practicing music again, I felt it even more.
Okay.
Because there were old parts in my brain that hadn't been activated for several years that had been there before the crash.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That were being reactivated and going, this is normal for you. You're coming back online. Hello, wake up. And it really helped. So the going back to dance, even though it wasn't a dance style I had previously studied, really was the aha moment. And then my friend who was teaching the dance classes was taking some time off to do her master's degree. And because I have an education background and a dance background, she asked if I would cover her classes for a semester. And I thought, yeah, but I don't have any background in like physical activity teaching it, like in the science. And I thought, oh, beyond a first aid certificate, I better go do something. So another friend was working for a local chain of fitness centers, and she was a dance person as well. And I'm like, how do you get into that? Maybe I should take like the theory course that fitness people take. And she said, oh yeah, here's what you do. So I ended up back at the Mount again. I keep showing up at that campus.
As a fellow alum, I salute you for this.
One of the past presidents said to me, Terry, you know graduating means you're supposed to leave, right? No, I don't know that. I'm like a bad penny. I keep turning up. And the fitness officer there at the time, Pat McDonald, I took exercise theory from her. She became a career mentor to me, and I was only going to take the theory course and then go teach dance for my friend for a semester, and that was going to be it.
Uh-huh.
That was it. Famous last words.
Mm-hmm.
Then I took, excuse me, and then I took the group exercise course. I was only going to teach aerobics once or twice to fill in if Pat needed a substitute at the Mount. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I hear you.
And then my phone started to ring. And it was places from all over the city going, hey, we just heard you just finish your certification. The ink was not dry yet on my certification.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I got some calls before I was technically finished because I still had to do my first aid research and I hadn't done it yet. And I was already getting calls to teach fitness. And
is this because people knew your background? So they knew?
No, okay, this was people calling, asking, rep, calling the Mount and saying, hey, do you guys have
any new... there's that much need.
Any new graduates? There was a huge need at the time. And I was one of the people she was highly recommending as brand new, fresh out of the training.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up working there. I ended up working for HRM. I ended up working at other universities. I've been all over the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it my accidental career. I did not mean for it to be a career. At the time, I was still substitute teaching for the school board and hoping to get a teaching job. And it got to the point where I got so many calls and emails and offers to teach a class here, a class there, whatever. And I was running around all over the city, but I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt fantastic for the first time in my life that I eventually called the school board and said, hey, guys, I quit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've gotten better offers from a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Don't call me every – take my number off the list. I'm not substituting anymore. And that was the real – beginning of everything stepping up and glowing up for me.
Okay.
Was that moment in which I really found my place in the world, as it were. And because I had the teaching background, because I had the dance background, my ability to lead fitness classes became, you know, quite unique. I was able to bring different things to it. I was able to communicate with people who previously had not felt welcome in fitness. And then in 2011, the opportunity for me to do a TEDx talk came up.
Oh, okay.
So the TED Talks became hugely popular. And I'd always done public speaking. I've always been told I was very good at it. Never really thought of it beyond that. But as the TED Talks became massively popular in the early 2010s, the local groups and coordinators and event planners started doing the TEDx events.
Mm-hmm.
And I had actually applied to one here in Halifax and didn't get selected. I thought, oh, well, yeah, them's the breaks. Mm. And actually applied for one up in Cape Breton and got selected for it. Found out later that my application to the one in Halifax didn't go through the system. They never did get my application. So here I was all heartbroken because Halifax didn't accept me. And I'm like, yeah. Turns out they never saw it. But I ended up going up to the convention center at Member 2 mm-hmm. in Sydney and doing the TEDx there in 2011.
Nice.
And by then I was already, doing workshops, doing the local fitness instructors conference, stuff like that. And had taken a program, I think it was in 2008, I took a training program called Belly Fit. So because I had been in the dance world and I taught dance a bit for recreation, my friend's class evolved into me having classes. It was belly dance we were teaching. And my friend who got me into fitness in the first place came into my office at the gym one day and she said, somebody's created a belly dance aerobics hybrid. They're having a course in Dieppe in New Brunswick. Let's go. Mm. And we got in the car and we went. And she and I were the first people in Nova Scotia to teach that program.
Okay.
And I'm still teaching it.
Nice.
And it's a wonderful program. It's a women-focused program. That really solidified some of the gender aspects of where there's gaps in access to physical activity for me. So then a few years later, I bumped into an old friend of mine from university. He's like, remember when we were undergrads and the Mount created that new master's degree in gender studies? And you said, oh, I'm going to do that degree someday. Did you ever go back and do that? And I went, no, I didn't. I completely forgot about that degree existing. I better get on the phone to the Mount. And so it was the fall of 2013. I started my master's degree.
Okay.
And I gave them the video of my TEDx talk and said, here's my application. Watch this video.
Nice.
This is my thesis proposal. And they went, yes, it is. Nice. You're in. So for over the next several years, I worked part-time on that and finally published my thesis a couple of years ago when I graduated. And the thesis is called The Pink Dumbbell Problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I ended up doing was looking at gender-specific gaps, mostly around women, but also gender nonconforming people, LGBTQ plus people, mm-hmm. of where there are gaps in exercise knowledge, where women in particular have been refused access to learning, and where there's also access gaps in like physical spaces, either because historically women haven't, there's plenty of gyms historically, just never allowed women in the door.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty rare since the late 90s, early 2000s, that's almost non-existent. But if you're of a certain age and you don't know that those policies have changed, you don't know women are allowed in the one gym in your town.
To say nothing of the informal attitudinal barriers when you walk in you get the looks from, sorry, meatheads, but from the meathead guys in
the gym rats.
Don't make you feel super welcome there.
That's right.
Which is still there.
Exactly. And then by that point, I was working in fitness full time. I was working in weight rooms doing floor supervision and training. I was teaching classes and I got to meet the meatheads and the gym rats and those kinds of people. And I got to see, I sort of got a sense of where there was good and there was bad. And I really came to realize, even though my background isn't strictly speaking in sociology, I got to realize that every gym has its own culture. Every studio, every rec center has its own fitness culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes those meatheads are they look intimidating, but they're actually really lovely people who mm-hmm. are welcoming. And I've met people who you would think would run you out of the gym with scary rhetoric and biases and bigotry. And in fact, they're not. They're the first person to come up to you and go, wow, great for you. I'm so proud of you for being here. And, mm-hmm. you know, and let me show you this and let me help you with this. So there's some biases we've learned, particularly, I think, from popular culture, from fictional media in particular, mm-hmm. that make us think somebody is going to be hateful when in fact they're actually the nicest person there.
Right.
And then the person who looks like they're going to be nice is the one who's got biases and may behave with bigotry and things like that. So you really actually can't tell by looking at somebody.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, so unconscious bias.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We've talked about that a time or two around this podcast.
I think we've covered that on this podcast once.
Yes, we definitely have. So I'm curious to bring it back to your courses here at Reach and the sort of things that you're teaching here. What sort of specific barriers do you find that people with disabilities are facing mm-hmm. into the fitness world mm-hmm. that are particular to them and that might be holding them back from things that obviously can be really beneficial for their physical health mm-hmm. and for their overall recovery and wellness?
Mm-hmm. There's a few. Some of it, again, is the sociological aspect mm-hmm. of not being explicitly welcome mm-hmm. To come into gyms. You do get the impression in certain gyms, particularly the ones that have like big walls of windows where you can see into the gym and you see very fit looking people working out.
Yeah.
That if your body doesn't match that sort of look, then that's not a place where you're welcome. Mm-hmm. Gyms, and particularly the people who do marketing, people with marketing degrees that don't work out, tend to market in what they call an aspirational sense.
Right.
So when you see advertisements for gyms, for workout videos, for workout clothing, the workout clothing ad copy is dreadful. Stock photography. Mm-hmm. You see the most perfect looking people, perfect bodies, perfect hair, perfect face, mm-hmm. And brand new clothing that just had the tags removed. Because yes. There's not a sweat stain or a scuff or anything anywhere. And I remember talking to a friend who studied marketing in university, and he was shocked when I said the marketing is keeping people out of the fitness, accessing fitness spaces, mm-hmm. Gyms or in classrooms. And he was shocked. He's like, but we put all of that on the advertisements so that you feel like if you come to this gym or you do this class, you'll look like that person. I'm like, yeah, but people are more realistic than that.
That may not be somebody's right. goal, too. It's my goal for going to the gym may not be, you know,
frankly,
sex appeal
so much
as feeling
healthy. I'd rather see somebody
who
looks like me.
Bingo.
Okay?
Yeah.
Who's wearing a pair of ratty sweatpants or whatever, going in, like, who's the size of me, because I'm like, okay, I'm going to be welcome, because we could have a whole podcast on me going to various gyms over my life.
Absolutely.
And my lack of feeling welcome, right? And my
absolutely.
Ability. And still to this day, the ability, when you talked about fitness clothing, right, to be able to buy, like, even if I wanted to have that clothing, right, well, I need to go to that gym for about 2 years before I could fit into that clothing, right? Mm-hmm. So, I think there are all kinds of, like, stigmas attached.
Absolutely.
One of the things that you said, which I wanted to come back to, was when you started back up in dance again, and you said, you know, your sort of brain did that rewiring, and I feel like what I was hearing is that it's almost like your physical, okay, and mental, okay, came together, okay, and the synapses was now
absolutely
why now you're firing on all cylinders, right? Mm-hmm. Because I like to say, because now it's bringing joy, right? Like, and don't you think joy, you know, brings more feelings of, I think there's lots of studies on, on that, when you're feeling joyful, when you're enjoying what you're doing, it's having some overall wellness. How do you feel about that?
I agree. And we do know now too, just in the last, not even 20 years, 10 to 15 years, we are starting to understand from the scientific research just how much physical activity affects the brain, how much the brain is involved in learning and performing physical activities, and how much connecting that activity with music is also part of it. There's been some really great work. If you have a look at Dance Nova Scotia, and I've been a Dance Nova Scotia member for quite a while. They've got a program called Dance for Health, and have been working with a researcher who has been studying dance in folks who have Parkinson's.
Interesting. Okay.
And it's something to do with the connection of not just physical activity, but physical activity and to music. That seems to be making different synapses fire up
feeling
in the brain.
Good already.
And like you said, firing on all cylinders is exactly the metaphor, because fibromyalgia or whatever was wrong with me at the time, the physical problems I was having from injuries not being treated properly, comes with brain fog, we call it. And for the first time in many, many years, the brain fog was clearing, and my all the synapses in my brain felt like they were coming back online again. And we now understand that every time you learn a new physical activity, whether that be exercise-based, whether it's a sport, a dance move, a piece of choreography, learning to play a piece of music on an instrument, because that's very physical. Your whole body plays music. It's not just your hands or your mouth or your whatever. all of that creates new neural pathways in your brain, because your brain has to send a signal to your hands, your feet, your arms, whatever is moving, to do the thing. Mm-hmm. Your brain has to do the thing before the rest of your body does the thing. And because many of us learn stuff like dance and music from an early enough age, hopefully, we are going back to parts of our brains that got developed very early on. So even when you're like me and you've acquired a brain injury, mm-hmm. years later, those parts of the brain, if they've already been developed, they can actually fire up again. It's like digging through an old hard drive and retrieving old files. Mm-hmm. And I know I keep using computer analogies, but the brain is that basically works for me the computer really of the well, body.
Terry, trust me.
Yeah, it is, absolutely.
It's like that. It's like retrieving old files off of an old hard drive and opening them up again. And music and dance in particular, but any sort of physical activity really seems to have that sort of almost magical effect on the brain.
I know I read a lot about the effects of dance in particular on depression, and the benefits of frequently doing enjoyable dance routines and activities, even just in your own kitchen, compared against some pretty intense medications for depression.
Absolutely.
It's pretty shocking how kind of on par the results are. It kind of blows my mind just how effective it is. Mm-hmm. I know personally, we talked about this an hour ago, I'm quite prone to depression. And if I don't get a certain amount of physical activity in my day, boy, does that rear its ugly head much, much faster. It takes very little physical activity to get me out of that rut and get me moving again.
Yeah.
But the effect is really immediate for me.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the thinking now, and I feel this makes sense to me from personal experience as well, is that dance in particular is because it makes areas of your brain that are different areas of your brain light up, as they say, that are responsible for different types of like organizational thinking, right? Like, am I on the beat of the music? Am I coordinating my limbs? You know, sometimes you might be doing one thing with your left side of your body and another thing with your right side of the body.
So you've seen me dance. No one said I was good. I just enjoy it.
Yeah, but well, sometimes that's intentional, though. Yeah. That's intentional. Or not. And it's interesting now that I know all of this, because I'll look at brand new people coming to a dance class or a dance event, or they're coming to like an aerobics dance hybrid. I just taught a class last night. I had some brand new people in the class. They've never danced before. They've never done aerobics before. So things that become very old hat once you've learned it are mind-blowing to somebody doing it the first time. Something that we consider very mundane, like a hamstring curl, that's in every aerobics class since, you know, we started doing aerobics in the early 80s. It's one of those standard moves everybody learns, but if you've never done it before, holy smokes, your brain is on fire for a moment when you're learning this. And the really cool thing for me, as I watch the people in front of me following my instructions and mirroring my movements, is I'm looking at people who have been coming to my Thursday night class every year for like 12, 13, 14, whatever years it's been now, who when they first started couldn't do a hamstring curl. And now I don't even have to finish the phrase hamstring curl out of my mouth and they're already doing it. Because they know I'm going to call that out at some point. They know how I cue the class. And the next person over to them is going, I am lost. What is happening? They're flailing. You see the look of concentration on their faces. And in a few more weeks, they're going to be smoothed out. And this will be normal. And they're not even going to have to think about what a hamstring curl is. I'm going to start saying the word and they'll do it.
Which is nice, too, because they can recognize from the person next to them, I'm sure you have some kind people in that class that kind of look at them and go, you know what? This was me not that long ago. And
absolutely
now you see how secondhand it is for me. But that kind of brings me back to the whole theme of your entire career is that seems to be what you're doing is saying, okay, yes, you can do this. It's not as hard and the benefits are going to be like you're seeing in me.
Absolutely.
And like you hear me talk about and things that you might not think about. The clearing of the brain fog, that connection between mind and body is always so interesting to me because I find I've talked to a number of particularly people who are going through severe depression and they almost think of their body as this meat sack they're attached to. And it's like, no, it has so much. Your physical health has so much of an impact on your mental health and just on your thought processes. There's no disconnect at all. You have just allowed yourself to become disconnected. So it's lovely that you're still that informal support network because unfortunately, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this, how far the system has come. with formal supports. Mm-hmm. I wonder, do you see enough of a positive change to make you relieved in any way? Or are we still...
Not in any tangible way. And by tangible, I mean funding. I had to have some nasty words a few years back with when I was the ED for the Fitness Instructors Association provincially. Mental health organizations, be they direct supports to patients or clients with mental health issues, be they government, be they research-based, what have you, how all started about probably close to 10 years ago now, saying, oh, exercise is great for mental health things. You should go exercise. What they failed to do in doing that was say anything about where to find exercise, what kind of exercise instructors to go to, how to tell a good one from a bad one, anything like that, where to get funding for that, nothing. There was just this blanket statement that became a soundbite in the mental health world that exercise is good for you. And yes, absolutely it is. Uh-huh. There's not a fitness instructor on this planet who's going to disagree with that statement. However, we as the fitness industry had no warning of this.
Oh, no.
We had no support from government. We had no training in mental health. It got to the point where myself and I had a board member who went above and beyond the call of duty of any volunteer at the time. She started calling around to all of the little community health boards in Nova Scotia and getting funding. And we eventually put on a special training for members, mostly for personal trainers, in fact, to take mental health first aid. Because it was getting desperate in our work lives. And see, most fitness instructors, personal trainers across Canada, but especially here in the East Coast, work in the job part time. They have a day job or a part time job, or they are entrepreneurs who work from home or something like that. So we don't have an employer who makes sure that we get professional development. We take responsibility directly, and we pay out of pocket for it in most cases.
Right.
And so it became a financial problem as well as an access problem to get some kind of training. And I remember doing sort of follow-up afterwards with a lot of the trainers who took that mental health first aid course and saying, it was great, but it was so generic that as a fitness instructor, it didn't really help me.
Yeah.
And there needs to be a reckoning of providing mental health training for fitness instructors. Uh-huh. The other thing is, of course, is that there is no legislation anywhere in the world that I've ever found, let alone here in Canada or Nova Scotia, that defines what a fitness instructor is.
Okay. So there's no sort of like licensing or anything of that nature. Okay.
So certification is strictly voluntary. Mm-hmm. People with no certification whatsoever can hang out a shingle and call themselves a personal trainer. They can call themselves a fitness instructor or a yoga teacher, what have you. Fortunately, most people working in the sector do not do that. Most people do get some kind of credential. Thank heavens. Now, those credentials vary in quality, in length, in depth, in everything, in expense. But generally speaking, you can have a very good fitness instructor come out of a course that takes a couple of weekends, because we'll crash course you through basic anatomy, basic adult education principles. You can tell a bad trainer if they don't know how to teach. Anybody can sit down and memorize an anatomy textbook. But if they can't teach it to anybody who has any level of understanding, including none, that's not a trainer to me. To me, a trainer or a fitness instructor is an educator.
Yeah.
Mind you, that's also my personal bias because I have an education degree. But I really, when I was doing that work of leading that association and teaching those courses, I really leaned heavily into the education side of it, because an instructor means teaching. A trainer means teaching. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter to me if you can do 40,000 variations of squats. If you can't explain that to the person standing in front of you, it's got no use. It's got no practical use.
And to say nothing of the real, the honest to God danger that I see of having a system that says, hey, exercise is great for your mental health. If you're in a mental health crisis, go exercise.
Well, this is what we were finding.
And then showing up to someone who doesn't know how to recognize those signs, let alone offer actual
this
tangible support.
This is exactly
support.
The problem we ended up coming up against a few years. This is about, oh gosh, when was this? This was just before the pandemic hit, so about 5 years ago. And we ended up getting this board member who gave her all to get this funding. I mean, what a rigmarole she went through to get bureaucracies on bureaucracies here to get this funding for us. And we went to a thing that was like announcing who was getting funding and stuff like that. And one of the higher up people in mental health in this province said, oh, this is so brilliant. How did you decide this? And I'm like, I decided we needed to do this because you left us in the lurch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You created a gap that needed filled. That's how we decided to fill a gap.
You left us in the breeze.
Yeah.
And I had to fight to get this, my board member and I had to fight to get this funding. And her face fell. And I'm like, don't you ever throw another group of professionals under the bus like this again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't you ever do this. Because not a single person in mental health stopped to think, what about the fitness instructors? We're throwing people on their doorstep. Do they have training? Do they have supports? Do they have resources? No. The only thing that really saved us is that all of our training, and it has been like this since the late 80s at least, when we started formal training in Canada for this, has been the rule that if you don't know what to do, you refer out.
Yeah.
You refer your client to another person, to mental health. We did do some, always did some mental health training around eating disorders and seeing in exercise, excessive exercise for people with eating disorders and body dysmorphia and things like that. But we really didn't do it for other mental health issues. And so that became the official rule, is if you see something that looks like there might be a mental health issue here, you refer immediately out to other services. But of course, that's a referral. That doesn't mean the client takes you up on it.
No, and it doesn't mean that, like you were saying, if somebody's not properly trained, that they'll even, or have been through it themselves, that they'll know how to recognize that. Yeah. And the only silver lining I can see here is that if there's one lesson we've learned today, it's that the most vulnerable people among us, they bounce back. So they're going to be okay. That's fine. We have, unfortunately, we're reaching, near the end, exactly. So I had to end with some sarcasm there, but
no, of course.
I do, beyond thanking you for coming in today, I want to thank you for coming in monthly as you do, because I think you've demonstrated that you have this sort of holistic understanding of people and where they're coming from and how you can tangibly help them. And in conjunction with what we're doing here, that's a really necessary component. I think we have a much higher success rate with our clients because we've added in a physical health component. Yes. That's not something that is our particular wheelhouse here. We're dealing a lot more with the mental
side
of things.
That's why you call me.
And you always answer and you come and you help and you've been an immense help to us. So thank you very much for that. Mm-hmm. You get up to a lot of things out there beyond classes once a month here at Reach.
So
this is your chance. Terry Roberts, please plug yourself thoroughly. There are so many places people can check out what you're up to.
You can search my name, Terry with an I, or you can search the Pink Dumbbell Problem and find me on all kinds of social media platforms. I've got a video channel on YouTube that hasn't been active lately, but because I've been doing other administrative work, you can find videos that I've done that are basically chunks of my master's thesis in short pieces. You can find me on all the social media platforms doing that work. Prior to COVID, I did a lot of public speaking work, which of course stopped during COVID and sort of switched to video work. Because I have been in that delivery mode for my content for quite a few years, I've given a lot of advice to people, fitness and otherwise, on how to add public speaking work to whatever it is you do, whether it's disability advocacy or training or what have you. So I am now with a few friends, fitness and dance friends mostly, starting, and music friends. I've got a fitness friend, a dance friend, and a musician friend all starting this new project with me. We are starting a new organization called Speakers Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. The paperwork just went in a couple of days ago.
Nice.
I should hear from the government any minute now that we're official.
Nice.
That's where my career is headed now, but I'll still always be doing a bit of the fitness and health and advocacy work. And right now, a lot of my work is, I'm not administrating the association or teaching the courses anymore. I've moved more into consultancy and advocacy work around fitness. So I'm talking to other NGOs. I'm talking to service organizations. I'm talking to, occasionally when I can get through them, government departments, political parties, political caucuses, that kind of thing, and doing this exact sort of advocacy work and saying, okay, yes, you're going to agree with me that exercise is good. Yes, that is a given in society now. Mm-hmm. Where can we take this? Where are disabled folks falling through the cracks? Where are persons of color not getting access? Where are there barriers to LGBTQ plus folks, which is a whole other area of barrierhood.
I could pick your brain for an hour about
that. We could do another couple of hours
basically
on that.
Basically, we're going to have you back in the future.
Yeah, that's another podcast to get to come. You know, folks with disabilities, any my big thing is intersectionality, of course, because I do have formal training in academically in feminist philosophy. And that's a big cornerstone of what we do. So where are there people falling through the cracks? Because I am somebody who, going back to that story of the car crash, fell through several cracks.
Yeah.
I got ignored because of biases, but I also got dismissed and unserved or underserved because I fell through several cracks in the system at the time. And some of those gaps have been closed, but not enough and not all of them. And they don't, the closures haven't intersected when people have multiple areas of vulnerability or intersecting oppressions. So there's a lot of work yet to be done on this. And what I'm finding is there's people out there in the world who are doing this work, but they don't really have a platform for it. They don't really feel like doing podcasts or making YouTube videos. But I know I have filled some gaps with my video series, but it's still not enough. So now I'm at the point where I've been in this work for 20-ish years now, coming up close on 20 years. And I'm at a point with my education level, my experience level, my age, what have you, that some of the bigger players in this province are ready to listen. I'm older than some of the bigger players in this province now. And they're like, yes, ma'am. Whereas a few years ago, they were like, hey, you're just a kid. I'm older than you. I know better. I'm not listening. So I'm really leveraging the fact that I hit a different demographic now.
Yeah.
And get, I'm trying to get more top level so this can come top down and I don't have to sort of talk to people who are struggling at the beginning of their journey. I can start hopefully setting some precedents and getting people to understand things at the policy level. I just had a big policy discussion with somebody in a medical field yesterday.
Because they still need the help, so that makes me happy.
here's a gap in your, you think you have a policy that doesn't even exist. You need to actually write this down, make it an official policy, and then educate your staff on it. And we had a really great chat about that because there are norms and then there are policies. And a lot of people think there are policies within the fact they've just got norms.
Yeah.
And we need to put some hard things in policies so that they really happen and that there's consequences if they don't happen. So if your policy is to be LGBTQ plus inclusive and somebody who's not part of that community does something that's not inclusive, you need to have a policy to follow to either train them on that inclusion or maybe relocate them to another department if it's or maybe get them into a new career and out of this one if they're not going to follow policy. But if you don't have a policy, you got nothing to stand on.
No.
So, yeah. So I've become a policy wonk is what I'm telling you.
Well, I'm glad you're doing the work. Thank you for that. Frankly, I think you're doing more than enough besides the policy work, which sounds like a horrifying thing to take on, but I'm glad somebody's doing it. I'm glad it's you. I'm just going to be picking your brain for an hour after we turn off the microphone. Oh, I feel sure, bad for our listeners now, but
you need to have an after hours version of the podcast so you can
there you go, exactly. Air all yes, the other stuff we reach after dark. That's what we need. We'll just stay here until after sunset.
I think a great way to wrap this up is one of the things you talked about was, you know, we still need to have, you know, access is still not, you know, we need to have more access. But I did want to thank you because I am a big believer that access, you know, does happen, you know, sometimes one person at a time. And you're providing or trying to create access in many areas of the things that you just described to us. My head's like very dizzy thinking about all the things that you're involved in. But just here at Reachability, you're providing access, okay, to the clients of Reachability that maybe had no idea that they could have access, right? Or giving them maybe that opportunity to realize, oh, this is bringing that, you know, kind of that joy back to my life. If I do this and then find it, where can I go? How can I access? Because I think that is a real thing. You know, when people hit a certain, you get at a certain rut, if you will, in your life. And, you know, one side of your brain probably knows what you should do, but somebody needs to be there to kind of give you the nudge. You know, but that's very important work.
One of the things that we haven't really touched on yet is how disability and poverty intersect. Mm-hmm. Right. And unfortunately, access to trained, certified fitness instructors and personal trainers is a poverty problem, mm-hmm. because, quite frankly, it's expensive. Mm-hmm. And there's not, in most cases, there's not a way to access that if you are, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, or yeah. if you are underpaid or on disability benefits or things like that. So there are some. If you're in HRM, for example, there are some ways to access recreation facilities for low or even sometimes no cost. A lot of, even the expensive gyms will allow you to, say, volunteer your time in exchange for a gym membership for however many hours or what have you. That's not super well known. And we've really got a picture in our minds that accessing gyms and personal trainers in particular is a luxury mm-hmm. service.
Well, you already described, like, you know, when the Mental Health Association mm-hmm. came out and said fitness, okay, will help with your mental yeah. wellness, right, wellness. Please cut that part.
Nope.
So now I'm in this, you know, as a client, mm-hmm. I'm in this conundrum. Okay, great. You're telling me I need this for wellness,
yep.
but mm-hmm. I don't have any leftover mm-hmm. money. How do I access yes. it? Right. So yeah. I agree. I think there's mm-hmm. we could go on. I think there's another session. Mm-hmm.
Right.
on
the financial.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
And the flip side of that is that there's a lot of great fitness things that are free, again, on YouTube and online. But how do you know who's a good instructor?
Right. Exactly.
And there's some bad ones
YouTube
out there.
YouTube and videos are all great. But you coming in here gives people not only the fact that you're someone that we trust. We trust your background. We trust mm-hmm. your knowledge base. We trust your level of empathy with the clients, mm-hmm. which is huge for our clients from their mm-hmm. backgrounds. But also they get the chance to ask you questions.
Oh, they do.
Which is
so much fun.
Oh my God. And also just the one major failing of learning things from YouTube is you don't get to actually ask these things. And sometimes exactly. it's not something that might have been important for the instructor to mention because it isn't relevant to absolutely every person, mm-hmm. but it is the one thing that is preventing this person from even beginning their journey. So to have you here as just a knowledge base and a resource and someone people feel comfortable asking mm-hmm. questions mm-hmm. to is a massive asset. Our client base, intersectional, just, oh my, the intersecting barriers faced by our clients and by our staff here in a lot of cases, yeah, that's a long laundry list. So to have you here helping people who are facing multiple barriers mm-hmm. is a massive, massive asset.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. We're going to put all of your links in the show notes so that people can find you. They can also find you here at Reachability. So if you somehow can't find Terry through her many, many videos, links, and public activities, you can always call us here at Reachability, 902-429-5878. You can write to us at withinreach@reachability.org. We will connect you as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry. I'm just going to say it right now. I'll be shocked if this is your sole appearance on this podcast.
Yes.
I have many questions left and many topics to talk about.
Many things to talk about.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Thanks for listening to Within Our Reach. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. If you have an idea for an episode topic you'd like us to cover, or if you'd like to join us as a guest on the podcast, reach out to us at withinourreach@reachability.org.